kid's really gonna get it. You boomtown rat.
This is no ordinary talent. Ladies and gentlemen, please meet Sinead O'Connor.
Folks, do me a favor, please welcome, and just in time for Thanksgiving, the Cranberries.
And the Grammy for Best Rock Album goes to How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, U2!
Irish music has made a lot of noise on the world stage over the last 40 years, and we've grown used to watching our homegrown heroes rise to the top. From indie hopefuls to global stars.
Performing the most played song of 2014, it is Hozier!
So how has rock music managed to elbow its way to the centre of the Irish cultural landscape? Good evening, I'm Cathal Funge, and over the next hour, we're going to take a trip back to a key year in the story of Irish rock.
Next year is going to be tough. There is no point in putting a gloss on that hard economic reality.
In 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, Happy 1977!
World of Culture called it When Two Sevens Clash.
Welcome along to 1977.
Tonight I want to have an unpleasant talk with you. The energy crisis has not yet overwhelmed us, but it will.
A year of gloomy headlines on the evening news.
Good evening. Elvis Presley died today. He was 42. Apparently it was a heart attack.
The climate for change was ripe.
The young kids of today, they're frustrated and bored. They're sick of being pushed around, told what to do.
Voicing the frustrations of a generation, punk goes overground.
Over the last 12 months, punk rock has become almost a battle cry in British society. For many people, it's a bigger threat to our way of life than Russian communism or hyperinflation.
Something is stirring back home as well.
With any boiling pot, the lid will eventually flip if you don't release the pressure. And that's what happened here, I think, in 1977. It all came together.
A generation fed up with 1970s Ireland seized their moment to create something new. Something modern.
Felt like we were part of something that was outside the norm, that was part of a rebellion, and doing it for the right reasons.
There seemed to be this unending stream of bands who blew you away.
I mean, we kind of knew what we were doing, but we hadn't a clue what we were doing as well, really, is the truth.
Jubilee year, and I'm sure all of you join with me in wishing Her Majesty a joyous and happy new year. What?
A lot of people are opening up their eyes and finding out that all we've got is the past. We've got no future, no future, no future, no future.
Strikes, power cuts, unemployment, racism had punks in the UK bawling no future. But what kind of country was Ireland in the 1970s?
I would characterise Ireland in the 1970s as a country going through a decade of transition.
That's Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern History at UCD.
The Republic is a very young country. 50% of the population are under the age of 25. And there's a lot of creativity. There are a lot of expressions of new ways of doing things, or demands that things be done differently, and of a swatting away of a lot of the older pieties. This is a mob world.
This is the modern world. Dermot is also the author of Ambiguous Republic, Ireland in the 1970s.
One of the things I found interesting in looking at the 1970s was the extent to which this question was being asked, is community dead? Are Irish values and Irish traditions under threat? The 1970s is a decade where those questions are being asked, and part of it has to do with the idea that there are new urban sensibilities or new urban values or dominant urban values in Irish society, that there's much more of a focus on the individual and the individual needs, and that is at odds with a traditional, familial, rural, caring Irish identity. Now, that identity may have been a myth in the first place, of course, but that comes with increased urbanisation and increased exposure to modernisation and increased exposure to abroad and increased exposure to television. It's not single channel land anymore.
Against Shrewsbury Town, match of the day at 10:05 on BBC One. First, more family fun with Bruce Forsyth and the Generation Game.
For the best part of 30 years, the showband scene had dominated Irish cultural life. Hundreds of bands crisscrossed the country, playing the hits of the day in large, packed-out, purpose-built ballrooms. There was the occasional sighting of a rock band, but they didn't hang around too long. Like Van Morrison and Phil Lynott, most ended up on the boat to Holyhead.
Dublin. After our affair, I swore that I'd leave Dublin. And in that line, I left behind the years, the tears and the memories of you in Dublin. At the quays, friends come to say farewell. We'd laugh and joke and smoke. And later on the boat, I'd cry over you in Dublin. How can I leave the town that brings me down, that has no jobs, but is blessed by God, Dublin? And at sea with blowing hair, I think of Dublin, of Grafton Street and Derby Square, and those of whom I really care, and you in Dublin.
Oh, I can hear the sailors cry, smell the sea and feel the sky.
The escape route to London was a must. Ireland was no place for rock music prior to 77. No support from radio, television, print or venues. Even record labels with offices in Ireland had little interest in trying to develop a local music scene. Here's Jackie Hayden, who in 1977...
I was marketing manager with CBS Records in our Dublin office. I got very frustrated because they turned down a succession of acts, like Horselips, for example, and they turned down U2. I don't think it was a kind of a superiority of the English over the Paddies, but I just think they felt that, well, you don't really know about this stuff. You guys don't know what's involved in signing an act and developing an act, so why don't you basically mind your own business? So there was no great incentive to do anything unless it was very commercial locally, something a bit like a show band act. But anything to do with rock music, you were kind of steered well away from.
By the early 70s, the bright lights of the dance hall days were beginning to fade. A younger generation, now living in urban areas, were looking for something new. And they found it in two bands that helped bring traditional Irish music to new places, which in turn revitalised the local music scene.
If you liked Irish music, you were redneck, you were definitely, it wasn't cool. It was attached to a kind of a very old-fashioned way of looking at the country.
Fachnall Kellig, one-time manager of the Boomtown Rats, and Sinead O'Connor.
Whereas when Planxty particularly came along, they just made it completely modern and absolutely normal, you know. So that, for me, musically, was the most exciting thing that happened. And that, in its own way, you couldn't call it punk rockish, but it was definitely a whole complete evolution and revolutionary period in Irish music.
One of the things that people will say now, I wouldn't have realised it at the time, is there was no real music industry in the early 70s in Ireland.
In early spring, when small birds sing.
Former music journalist with Hot Press, now football correspondent with The Examiner, Liam Mackey.
Well, Horselips changed all that because they brought, and it was a big thrill to those of us who, you know, were getting into music. The Rolling Stones mobile brought it down to some house down the country, and they recorded Happy to Meet, Sorry to Part, their first album. And they were very influential on the punk scene. It doesn't seem like an obvious fit, kind of Celtic rock band wearing flared pants and satins and stuff. But they had that indie spirit, which later informed punk and new wave.
Outside of Ireland, bands like the Ramones brought rock and roll back to its bare essentials. Their timing was perfect. By 76, people were getting bored with rock gods and never-ending guitar solos. It was time for something new. An intervention was needed. Very few people had taken much notice of punk in the UK until Freddie Mercury developed a toothache, pulled out of a live television appearance, and was replaced by an unknown band called the Sex Pistols.
They are punk rockers, a new craze, they tell me. You see, they are as drunk as I am. They are clean by comparison. They are a group called the Sex Pistols. Go on, you've got another 5 seconds. Say something outrageous.
You dirty balls.
A few swear words on tea time telly and the Pistols found themselves national celebrities, their faces plastered across the front page of every newspaper the following morning.
Well, that's it for tonight.
Meanwhile, on Irish television...
a sober-looking record like this, Loretta Lynn, the best of Loretta Lynn. Buried deep in there is a song called The Pill. And because of the song called The Pill, Loretta Lynn got on the front cover of both Time and Newsweek last year. And the message of The Pill is that the pill is the answer to all the problems that modern women face.
I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
Father Brian D'Arcy was investigating the moral effects of pop.
What about pop and religion? Is pop just cashing in on religion, as it were, to make a popular theme of it? Or has it really brought people nearer to God?
Up in Derry, John O'Neill from The Undertones wasn't in any way worried about the impact pop music was having on his morals. He was more concerned about how bad it had become prior to 77. The destroy and create ethos of punk couldn't have come at a better time.
By 76, 77, Total Pop was appalling. It was really bad. And that sort of romantic thing in our heads, I think, when you think of Total Pop, it's when we were first got into music, and that was the glam rock time. 71, 72, and that's when Top of Pops was great, you know, from, you know, Slade, Mud, T-Rex. It was just one great song after another, but by 77, that was, you know, before punk kind of started getting on Top of Pops, it was really bad. It was just full of bland, horrendous music.
'Cause you know you've got to save your kisses for me, save all your kisses for me.
There's gotta be a better alternative to this. One of the things that inspired people to say enough's enough.
And the first punk stroke new wave band to appear on Top of the Pops? Well, they happen to be a bunch of lads from Dunleary.
Come on, you're not supposed to enjoy yourselves. Pay attention at the back. After all, it is Top of the Pops.
Geldof said something like, "This band next Thursday, Top of the Pops." And I thought, get away in your dreams, in your dreams.
Broadcaster and musician Tom Dunn recalling the day he saw this unknown band called the Boomtown Rats supporting Thin Lizzy at Daily Mount in August 77.
And we tuned in the following Thursday and there's an Irish punk rock band on Top of the Pops. It's just incredible.
They're everywhere. The Boomtown Rats here. Bit of social comment for you. Have a listen to the lyrics on this.
Things happened very quickly.
The Boomtown Rats' then manager, Faulkner Kelly.
We were in the fortunate position of being in this transitional period between outrage of punk, you know, and, oh, we can't play God Save the Queen and all that kind of thing, and The Clash, and then that beginning to dissolve almost into what was called New Wave. So the Rats were fortunate that right at that time, the first single came out, Looking After Number One came out, and it had sufficient, I would have said faux anger, but anger and energy and attack and hooks in it to be acceptable, on the verge of not acceptable, but acceptable to Radio One. So it became the first kind of playlisted non-punk but still a feeling of punk about it song, and as a result of that it went into the top 10. So within 4 months of 5 months of moving to England, they were on Top of the Pops. So it all seemed really easy and perfectly natural.
Crashing into the living rooms of millions across the UK and Ireland, the Rats had arrived. Not bad for a band that started out in the barren world of 1970s Irish rock. Lee Mackey was still in school when he started following Geldof and his crew around town.
Geldof had this band who were all hairy looking dudes like the rest of us. If you look at their early photos of 75, bushy moustaches and hair. And then within about a year, they were short hair, sharp suits. And Geldof was at Mourne's Hotel with a cut off shirt with Geldof is God graffitied across the front of the shirt.
Mourne's was one of the few venues in Ireland dedicated to promoting and supporting new music. So no surprises, it was buried underground.
It's on the corner of Garner Street and Talbot Street.
That's Smiley Bulger. He ran the gigs at Mourne's.
Basically, it was then, and it still is, a country hotel. But they had a beautiful ballroom downstairs. Great acoustics. So there was just something about the room that was all, a lot of wood. I think we started doing one night and then, you know, another night. And then eventually we just took the whole place over. So we had the whole place to ourselves. We built the stage, you know, we put in lights. You know, more or less one of the early custom-built venues. There were some gigs there that were just phenomenal.
At one of those gigs was Richard Branson, who was in town hoping to sign the Rats to his Virgin label.
At one stage we rang Rentokil, the pest controllers, and asked them did they have any kind of materials related to rats. And they had a film, some kind of a promotional film or some kind of a film about rats. And before the gig that Branson came to, we put up this kind of big paper screen in front of the stage in Morin's Hotel and projected this rat-catching film. And the place was packed. And then as the film was projected, then as it came near its end, the band was lined up behind the screen and started playing. And Geloff slashed his way through the screen and, of course, bottles and glasses started flying all over the place, and Branson was in the corner kind of very, very concerned for his well-being. It was just a mad scene. Very small, but clearly something was going on.
There you go. Let's do it for the Bumptown Rats. It's very ridiculous game.
That's Smiley again there on the end of a live recording of the Rats in Mourns, which they released on the B-side of Looking After Number One. So how did the stars of a relatively obscure underground music scene get people like Richard Branson flying into Dublin trying to sign them? Well, it seems it was all thanks to a cheaply recorded demo tape.
I think I had 40 quid in a bank account, and I paid for the band to go into the Eamon Andrews Studios in Harcourt Street and record in like a 4 hours, four songs. And then myself and Geldof went off to London. Through a completely random, literally bumping into somebody that I knew, we found ourselves in Phonogram Records. Geldof left the room. I gave these two guys that we were introduced to this cassette tape with four songs on it. They put it on, they cranked it up really loud, which was kind of impressive, and they started jumping around the room.
One of those guys was Nigel Grange, who shortly after hearing that demo tape set up his own label, Ensign. The Rats were one of his first signings, and within months had chalked up two UK top 20 singles. Branson, by the way, did try and outbid Grange, but it wasn't to be, and he eventually signed another band that made quite a bit of noise in the summer of 77 with their debut album Nevermind the Bollocks. The Boomtown Rats blazed the trail for others to follow, but they weren't the first to get a foot in the door.
77 is our key year.
Pete Holiday from Dublin band The Radiators from Space, who proudly call themselves
Ireland's first, I repeat the word, first punk band.
The Radiators formed in 76 and were also part of the Morin's Hotel scene. Probably best known for their classic album Ghost Town, The Radiators' lineup included the immense songwriting talent of Philip Chevron, who would later become a pivotal member of the Pogues. Philip sadly passed away in 2013, but back in 77, he penned Ireland's first punk hit single. The Outsiders were in.
Some broken hearts never mend. And now for a new entry, straight in at number 17, Ireland's first punk rock band with television screen. Here are The Radiators from Space.
My favourite review actually is in the Record Mirror, which just said, "Crash, bang, thud, wallop, more unforgettable punk," which is the one I remember. But people still remember it, so, you know, we proved them wrong. Our starting point was unique in many ways, you know, and it was almost as if we'd gone back. If you look at the structure, musical structure of television screen, it really is jolly good, you know, to be honest, you know, in terms of the chord changes, etc. But it's just got this punk attitude thrown on top. Well, Philip wrote the words, but it's really about, to a large degree, it's about, you know, the uncertainty of youth. You know, who do I want to be and where do I want to be, you know? And also, I'm sort of unhappy, and that's why I want to get my Telecaster guitar and smash it through the television screen, which, ironically enough, you know, taking the current political circumstances, we still feel exactly the same way, you know? So it was like a call to arms, really. Let's change things, you know. I think even so, in the Irish market, certainly it was part of almost like a jigsaw puzzle of pieces that began to form and do exactly what we'd hoped for, which was like take a youth culture that would suddenly break free from the shackles of De Valera's oppression and be able to freely express themselves in a unique way.
Now, you might argue number 17 in the national chart wasn't exactly setting the world alight, but television screen was, as Pete Holliday mentioned there, a call to arms. It struck a blow of independence for an emerging local scene, and more importantly, it inspired others to take up the mantle. Here's Jackie Hayden again.
Yeah, when something like television screen comes and sort of breaks the rules and gets into the Irish charts and gets on Irish radio and gets a band written about in the national newspapers, I think that acts as a great encouragement to other bands who then feel, well, if they can do it, we can do it. And I think that's kind of always a good thing in any music field, but particularly in Ireland, because we weren't used to that sort of thing happening.
That was Ireland's first punk rock band, The Radiators from Space and Television Screen.
Star Wars, a billion years in the making, and it's coming to your galaxy this summer.
In the summer of 77, as Star Wars became the must-see movie in the States and punk collided with the Silver Jubilee celebrations in the UK, another underground music scene was bubbling under, ready to explode. Donna Summer's I Feel Love wasn't just the sound of that summer, it was the sound of the future. A few months later, John Travolta's dazzling white suit helped disco become a worldwide phenomenon. Back in Ireland, King Lear was on the Leaving Cert and pop music was a topic of discussion during the general election.
I think it's a gimmick. I have been interested in pop all my life. I'm not impressed by the lyrics of the song. I'm not impressed by the presentation of it. That's just my personal view.
The song being reviewed was Your Kind of Country, released by Fianna Fáil in a bid to inspire the youth of the nation to become interested in politics. Do you want to hear some of it? Well, not sure how much it helped, but by the end of June, Jack Lynch had won a record 20-seat Dáil majority, and Fianna Fáil were back in power. On the same night that Liam Cosgrave was admitting defeat in the election, the sleepy rural town of Macroom in Cork was coming to life as it staged Ireland's first outdoor rock festival.
At the time, it was brand new. We've since gone on to do this all the time.
Broadcaster John Creedon, who in 1977...
77, yeah, would have been... I'd have been 17 or 18. 18 and 77, yeah. There was something, I think, in the Celtic DNA that just loves a big gathering. Even back in ancient times, there was the Cruinniú, where thousands would gather from all over the country. We still love it, whether it's, you know, per capita, given the size of the country, we turn out some big crowds, whether it's All-Ireland Finals, whether it's the Pope and the Phoenix Park. If there's something going on, we all want to be there. So when the word got out, as I remember it, that this was going on, I had no idea what to expect. I just thought it was a gig that he... And I'm thinking, Jesus, Gallagher's bringing Macroom. Why wouldn't he do the City Hall? And then as it became more apparent what was going on, everybody was talking about it. There's people coming down from Dublin. There's
people coming from England for the first time, hearing about Ireland and the opportunity for people of different cultures and North and South and the Europeans coming in.
I met one bunch of lads from Dungarvan who came by in a van, and they had met a Dutch fella who was hitching for the ferry. He was heading east and they picked him up but insisted that he came to Macroom with them. So he missed his ferry, but he fell out of a van with a flag and a cider in his hand and went for it, enjoyed his weekend.
It was quite a mingling of people, so it was exciting, and you could see why you had all this extra audience who'd come just to the town just to see the way people dress differently or whatever.
I do remember it would have been the first time in my life that I saw the proverbial sea of denim and dodgy haircuts, really bad haircuts, little leather bomber jackets, bags, 24-inch parallels.
Jan Creedon, and you also heard the voice of a man who played a key role in making the festival a success, Donald Gallagher.
Back in 1977, I was managing my brother Rory Gallagher.
I hope you enjoyed the festival so far.
And we got approached to know if we'd do a concert in Macroom. It wasn't necessarily a festival, and as I understood it, it was to play a marquee that had been erected in the town. And initially I refused. Rock didn't work out in the countryside.
Macroom, a small West Cork town with a population of around 3,000, was struggling by the mid-70s. A local committee with an average age of 25 got together to look at ways of bringing some visitors and business into the town, and over a few pints one night they settled on the idea of hosting Ireland's first rock festival. After all, Woodstock had worked in the States and the English had Glastonbury, so why couldn't the Irish have the Macroom Mountain Dew Festival? Marianne Faithfull played a smaller indoor event in 76, and drawing up plans for the following year, the committee knew they needed a big name to pull in the crowds. Top of their wish list was a guitar hero from down the road. And the committee came up with a uniquely Irish way of trying to persuade Donald to get his brother to play.
People responsible kept ringing my mother's house in Cork, and her family had come from that part of the world as well, so there was family back out that way. So my mother said, "Oh, don't embarrass me, at least go down and talk to those people, they're our people." So I set off in my car, went down and had a conversation about the fact that, thank you very much for the offer, but Rory didn't play in marquees, and all the reasons why. And then it was proposed that there was the castle could be used as a venue, and it had a natural amphitheatre up one side. The far side had a river, so it gave it very good security. And all the component parts fell into place, and thereby hangs a tale 40 years later.
Has the chance to make sure that the European Cup comes to Liverpool for the first time.
For Rory, he probably wanted, like every night, it was a cup final mentality for him. He'd want to play the best gig he ever played, or give another percent beyond the percent he'd given the night before.
Neil against Knight. And with such simplicity, the European Cup surely is won.
And he did an astounding gig that year. He did really. So he was pleased.
I mean, I'd be a liar if I said I couldn't. I sat on every word and remember every part of that set. But I remember the feeling. I remember that huge sense of togetherness, and because, like, rock and roll was extramural, really. It wasn't as mainstream as it is now, you know. There wasn't a variety of dress codes available to people unless you wanted to stand out, and all of a sudden you went, look at him over there standing out. What are you standing out for? So, like, there was a huge sense that those of us who loved our music and who aspired to a certain degree of social freedom, that we weren't alone. There were actually thousands, and it was a growing movement. And I think all these things are catalysts for themselves. In other words, it continues to move on, and it did move on from there, you know. There was a huge beat in the air, like there really was. All of a sudden, we'd arrived, you know.
Like so many things that happened around the country in 77, Macroom was about a bunch of people just going for it. Building stages, shipping in PA systems from the UK. They were pioneers of their time, breaking new ground for others to follow.
Myself and my brother and our friend next door decided we'd go down to the Macroom show. I think I was 15 at the time. And we got a kind of package ticket, which was a coach trip down the show and then a coach trip back. That was the first time I ever went to what you might call a big gig. You know, I've been to a few small shows, but that was the first ever big gig. Rory was astonishing. You know, it was one of those great concerts. And it was during, I think, probably the heyday of his band as well. All the best musicians were playing that day with him.
The Edge sharing his memories of attending the Macroom Mountain Dew Festival in 77. And that's taken from the excellent documentary Ghost Blues, The Story of Rory Gallagher. With little or no music coverage in the newspapers or a national youth-orientated radio station to advertise on, the arrival of Ireland's first dedicated rock paper couldn't have come at a better time to boost the Macroom publicity machine. Supported by Donald Gallagher and featuring his brother on the cover of the first issue, Hot Press landed in shops across the country 2 weeks before the festival kicked off. That summer, Tom Dunn was in the Gaeltacht with his mate Cormac, and Liam Mackey was finishing up his first year in college. Hot Press arrived at a good time for both.
Hot Press was the sound of 77 and the turmoil of 77 and the energy of 77 and whatever the hell was going on in 1977. It was all there reflected in Hot Press. I mean, that was what it was. I was in journalism college and I wanted to, you know, I'd read The Enemy. It was my Bible every week. I couldn't wait to buy it every week. I bought loads of music. So the idea that there was this magazine, Hot Press, and that they'd already told me or asked me, would I be interested in writing for them? For an 18-year-old, that just seemed like all my dreams had come true. I was never going to be a rock star, but, you know, if I could write about it, that'd be great.
We were in the Gaeltacht, and I literally can remember standing in the queue to buy and seeing Hot Press there and feeling like we are not the only two people in the world who are into music. There are actually others. It was like being a member almost of a weird community. You know, they didn't have equal rights in Ireland or something, and trying to find other people like yourself. It was a hard search, I'll tell you, sometimes.
Cork was another country back then because we had our own newspapers and so on. So we didn't have social media, you know. The only kind of outside information, I suppose, we would have would be Hot Press.
This is Elvira Butler, label boss at Weakest Records.
77 was a year of beginnings.
Back in 77, Elvira was an art student and the ENTS officer at UCC.
I suppose what really stands out in 77 for me would be the Stranglers gig. I never ever saw myself as a confident person, but it never occurred to me that it couldn't be done. Because I kind of think, how on earth did I run the Stranglers? I mean, when I think back on that gig, it was actually nerve-wracking. There are people standing up, like on City Hall, is, you know, maybe three stories high or something. There's kind of window ledges, imitation windows, like up along. People stand, I don't know how they got up on them. People standing on the, you know, the front of the parapet of the balcony. Absolutely out of it, because it was like the tension was just building. It was an amazing gig. How? I have no idea how I did it.
After putting on gigs like the Stranglers and Dr. Feelgood at City Hall, in November 77, Elvira started hosting a weekly club night at the Arcadia Ballroom in Cork City called Downtown Campus.
Everybody went to the Arc, like on a Saturday night, no matter who was playing there. It was a mausoleum of a building, you know. It was just like a big empty barn. I suppose it was like a pretty magical time. I mean, just the fact that I suppose that people were actually having fun. What I really liked about it was, I suppose, you had the same people there week after week and you got to know people. And so there was a real kind of community party atmosphere, I suppose, in a way. There was like a disco, a DJ stage up to the side. So I'd nip up on that and watch the crowd and the band. Like, I remember Psychedelic Furs playing support to the members, the singer, Richard Butler, I suppose having a very kind of cool external image, but like turning around away from the crowd to kind of break out in a big smile because he couldn't believe how well they were going down, you know. They were great nights, really. Whether I appreciated enough when it was going on, I don't know, but I've never come across anything like it since.
Gigs at the Arcadia became legendary, with the likes of XTC, The Cure, The Specials, U2, 15 Times, playing there over the next few years and firing the imagination of kids across the city. The Arcadia, similar to Mourne's in Dublin, became the focal point of a new and emerging local scene in Cork, out of which came bands like Nun Attack, Stump and Micro Disney in the 80s, who in turn influenced the next generation. We'll be right back. And on the 7th of January 1993, two of those bands, the Sultans of Ping FC and the Frankenwalters, both appeared on the same episode of Top of the Pops. As local music scenes began to pop up across the country, having a magazine like Hot Press was vital to the encouragement of Irish music.
There were so many different levels. One, you could get reviewed, and often the people who reviewed you were people you really respected. Bill Graham was one of them. He was a top-notch journalist of his generation. He was one of the leading lights, I think, worldwide. He could have gone anywhere. He could have worked for Rolling Stone or The Enemy, wherever he wanted to go. He had a great ear for music. He was really an incredibly insightful man. So you were surrendering yourself to, you know, a review from Bill. And it wouldn't be over the top. It would be honest. But you need that kind of feedback. And then there were other people as well. You know, Lee Mackey was a great writer at the time as well. So to throw yourself up for assessment was huge. Your demo tape would get reviewed, your gigs would get reviewed, and then if things went well, you'd get an interview, and suddenly you had things to show people as you went to A&R people or English record labels. You could show that you'd done something in Ireland, and that got you in the door, no question about it. They paid attention, they respected Hot Press.
A couple of months after McCroom, Phil Lynott was on the cover of Hot Press, and we'll hear about that after this.
Doubt you have your own opinions, and we'd like to hear what those are. Whether you think that punk is a threat to society, you can contact us now while we're on the air by phoning in on 061, that's the Manchester code, of course. 061.
I just can't believe he's dead. It's terrible.
In the same week as Elvis died, Dublin rock fans were getting ready to welcome home their king. Dublin, August 21st, and the north side was enjoying one hell of a day out.
Playing from right to left, Kerry. Playing from left to right, Dublin. All-Ireland football semi-final, Croke Park, 1977.
Thousands packed into Croke Park to watch Dublin play Kerry in what many still consider to be the greatest Gaelic football match of all time.
Referee Seamus Murray checking the players. He's ready, and the game is on.
A mere mile up the road, rock fans were enjoying their biggest day out in the city, helping Philo celebrate his 28th birthday.
I'd always been a Thin Lizzy fan. I mean, the only man who ever made it to the wall of my bedroom was Phil Lynott.
That's Helen Shaw.
In 1977, I was 15 and had done my Intercert, and it was the Intercert then. I don't recall it being this big, big light bulb moment about Daily Mount. It was just brilliant. This is happening. It's in our backyard. I'm Whitehall. The rest of the gang were all Drumcondra. We all walked up. It was our neck of the woods.
Mikey Sheehy, first goal of the game, the point.
Croke Park is at one side of Drumcondra and Daily Mount on the other, if you see it as an axis like that, that you could actually hear each other. And there was a sense in which the roars that we were very aware during the afternoon about what was happening in Croke Park.
It must be, it is, it's a goal! John McCarthy was scoring!
But also there was a sense, because it's an audioscape, that you were very aware of the physical sound of the two places. And certainly Croke Park, people who were in Croke Park, very much said that they could hear Daily Mount. And, you know, we could definitely hear the cheers and the cries, and the roar is probably a much more precise word from Croke Park.
In now to Bernard Logan. He's in front of the goal. He can't miss. He has it.
Daily Mount was billed as Dublin's first major open-air rock festival, and for Lee Mackey, it was a landmark moment in Irish music.
And there's the final whistle, and Dublin have qualified for the All-Ireland final of 1977.
A soldier of fortune came home from war.
Was a really interesting bill because it reflected the old school. Stagger Lee were on it, Fairport Convention, and then the newer ones, Graham Parker and The Rumour, great, great band, and The Rats and The Radiators. But that was a significant day, a huge crowd at Daily Mount Park, and Lizzie Cock of the Walk, and I was there, and I just remember it as being fantastic, you know, and an experience like nothing. My generation hadn't experienced that before. If you'd been to McCroom, you had to some degree, but this was my first taste of it, and for a lot of people in Dublin, it was our first taste of a proper rock festival.
Mm-hmm.
The very best gigs take music and elevate it to a whole other experience. And for Tom, Helen and Liam, who were all teenagers at the time, that gig at Daily Mount is an experience that still resonates 40 years on.
Never been to anything like it before. I couldn't believe that you're going to spend all day waiting to see bands. That seemed crazy, just see one band and go home. And it was all very basic, food and toilets and everything. But then lo and behold, there was a very small contingent of punks in the crowd. And they were, it was like seeing unicorns. There were these fabulous creatures with pierced noses and spiky hair. And I thought they were incredible. And the girls with them, they were incredible as well.
We were really excited about Boomtown Rats. And Bob Geldof did light the crowd because it was the first time, obviously, I'd seen him. And it was that sense where his whole manner and his attitude was quite electric. So that was probably a moment where we turned into that, and that was all taking off in Dublin.
And then Thin Lizzy, rock star, like a supernova, like nothing else on earth, and certainly not afraid of the Boomtown Rats. He used to do this thing where they'd have a kind of super trooper light that would reflect onto his guitar, and there was a shining silver, you know, fingerboard on the guitar, and he would direct it into the crowd, and it was just sensational. He was a living, breathing rock star like nothing else on earth. So they were amazing, and I'd never seen anything like it in my life.
Now, for me, the Radiators were kind of my generation's band, but I loved Lizzy too. I mean, I really did. And that whole day just has a kind of magical thing in my memory. And particularly, you know, I got to know Philip Linnett a little bit over the years through Hot Press. And the memory of him now is poignant, but it's great to have it, of him coming back as the King of Dublin City, his town, you know. On stage, the Jacks are back, and the whole crowd rising to him, and the Radiators were there, and the Rads were there, and it was just great.
I was sitting on the shoulders of some lad who was kind enough to endure that for practically the whole gig. I would have not been able to see much unless somebody did that, given I'm only about 5 foot. The standout moment for me, and I'd say for many people that night, was the performance of Dancing in the Moonlight.
And it was Daily Mail Park, dark. I'm sure there was a moon, and everybody is singing it. And you're just thinking, oh, this is the greatest night of my life ever.
And probably something like Daily Mail, without really being aware about it when I went to it, that it gave you that sense that live performance is what makes music magical and special.
And that kind of sense of camaraderie that I'd never experienced before. By the end of the night, all bonds were broken. Everyone loves all the bands, and we're all having a great time. You know, it was very memorable.
Two months after Daily Mount, one of the leading lights of the UK punk scene would cross the Irish Sea for a visit that would cast a long shadow over the country's subsequent rock scene. And we'll hear about that next.
Welcome back, punksters.
When The Clash came to Belfast, that was big news for us, you know. It was going to be the gig that you absolutely wanted to go to.
Meet Paul Burgess, a huge Clash fan.
Mick Jones wore a red armband on his motorcycle jacket that said Red Army. So I had one of those, of course, I had to have one of those. And was running around Belfast with a Red Army, you know, armband on with a sort of hammer and sickle on it or something.
Paul is drummer and lyricist with the band Roofrex.
That's R-U-E-F-R-E-X, not the things on top of cars.
And they formed in Belfast in 1977.
There was nothing to speak of in terms of an alternative culture or a youth culture. Everything was subsumed into Protestant or Catholic niceness or unionist and so on.
Most touring bands didn't bother coming to Ireland in the 70s. Then again, The Clash were not your average run-of-the-mill band. They released their debut album in 77 and were booked in to play the Ulster Hall in Belfast and the Examination Hall in Trinity College. Neither a punk stronghold.
No problem at all. Okay, well, Dublin in 1977 was pretty grim, to say the least. Are you okay with that? Yeah, okay.
This is Jake O'Reilly.
I'm the drummer in the Blades. But in 1977, I was, as Paul McCartney would have described, a college pudding, just out of school.
The Clash at Trinity was a life-changing gig for Manny.
The big thing was the day the Clash played in Trinity. I think it just changed everything. It was, you'd been reading about bands and you'd seen them on television and maybe the odd local punk band, but the Clash in Trinity was a different, just a step up completely.
Almost 40 years later, the seismic impact that gig had on them as a band inspired U2 to write "This Is Where You Can Reach Me Now." The Belfast gig also remains a talking point, mostly because it never happened. It was called off by the authorities after the insurance cover for the concert was withdrawn at the last minute. As word spread to the crowd outside, it caused a mini riot. So the Clash in Ireland, one band, two very different nights out in two very different cities in 1977.
I remember exactly what it was like as we were arriving along the cobblestones to this fine big grand hall in Trinity. You could hear the support band were on actually when we arrived there, a band called the Count Bishops. I didn't know much about them, but you could hear them in the background, and there was a kind of, there's a bunch of people, there was loads of people outside, and there was the usual carry-on that you get outside gigs, someone too drunk throwing up and people pushing each other around.
My memory of it is it just seemed to go through the crowd. I don't know where it started, but you know, people were saying it's off, it's cancelled.
The exam hall, it isn't the kind of place you expect to see a punk band at all. And it's not like that kind of a venue. It's a very tall building. It's long and tall. And it was quite bright inside.
I think somebody came out, somebody official came out and said, right, you know, sort of, you guys, it's not happening, everybody go home. Nobody was going to go anywhere.
And there was real edginess about the whole thing. And because of what had gone on, I think the one in Belfast had been cancelled.
When they were stopped, as we were told, that was tantamount to under the J, the Kleiser going down under the jackboot of the machine kind of thing for their ideals, you know. And we have to show them that we're not going to let this, we're not going to, in our own time sort of thing, you know.
When you looked around then, you could see there was all these people in their bin liners and whatever, and you know, their safety pins, and guys with like school jackets on with safety pins all the way down that they put in themselves. They must have spent hours and hours preparing themselves. And there was like, there was that kind of contingent. And then there was, I suppose, college boys with duffel coats on and scarves, and then there'd be a lot of shoegazers, you know, people just stand there waiting for something to happen.
Given the times that it was and given the city that it was, there was, you know, a lot of ill feeling against the RUC and against the British Army, not necessarily for political reasons in regards to the Irish question, but more just because these people were on the streets and they were telling you what to do. And sometimes the people telling you what to do weren't that much older than you, but they happened to be wearing uniforms and had guns.
London's burning! London's burning!
Strummer in the middle was just pent up, you know, angry little man, you know, just a troublemaker, you know, those kind of guys, leader of a gang.
So there was a genuine kind of, you know, us against them situation that was very quickly coming to the fore. It didn't take an awful lot for that to come to the fore in Belfast in 1977.
There were so many people spitting, or gobbing as they call it, at the band that it would have caught, you know, the lights were refracting through it and you could see kind of it was just the weirdest thing. And we didn't know what it was. And we were looking, what is that? And then it dawned on us, you know, the horror of the thought of it. And I'd say the poor fellas on stage just couldn't believe what was happening to them.
It starts with disbelief, then it turns into kind of confusion, then it turns into anger, and then, and I always remember this, then you hear the first bottle breaking. Somebody has thrown a bottle, you know, and it's almost like that's it, then it's on, you know. And that's what kind of happened in those stages. In a way, it's something as innocent as somebody just, you know, somebody at the back of the crowd throws a bottle and the next thing, oh, well, now we know where we all stand. It's happening, it's on, you know.
Halfway through the gig, in fact, a lot of people started turning around and looking up, and there's all these guys, these old fellas up on the balcony in dicky bows, and there must have been some sort of a dinner or something on or whatever, and they were told to come down and have a look at these chaps on stage in their exam hall.
I'd be lying to say that it's sort of quickly escalated into this kind of huge toing and froing of security forces and punk rockers and so on. It was, in Belfast terms, it was a fairly minimal kind of exchange. And then I think what broke it up, paradoxically, what broke it up very quickly was word got round that the Clash had gone back to the Europa. So people started to leave to go around to the Europa.
So it kind of broke itself up, really. And the Clash broke it up indirectly.
I wouldn't say any of them broke into a smile during the whole gig. They were just angry, four angry young men, and they just had a message to give, and by God, they got it across. You know, it was just brilliant. Brilliant gig.
Jake O'Reilly from The Blades and Paul Burgess from Roof Rex remembering their dates with The Clash in October 77. The riot in Belfast has passed into folklore, with local punks affectionately referring to it as the Battle of Bedford Street. Some claim it was the night that kick-started the Belfast punk rock scene, which is probably a bit of a stretch, but what we can say for certain is the onset of punk couldn't have come at a better time for musicians from both sides of the community. Within 12 months of The Clash's visit to the city, local bands like Rudy, Protex, The Outcasts, Roof Rex and Stiff Little Fingers had all released classic punk singles. Meanwhile, 70 miles up the road in Derry,
living in Derry, you weren't bored, because you couldn't, because it was, there was so much horrendous things happening.
That's John O'Neill again.
Music was an escape from it all, and just luckily enough, punk happened at the right time for us.
Rhythm guitarist and songwriter with the Undertones.
We knew by the mid-70s, 77 anyway, that, you know, we had something that was pretty good. We didn't know how good it was.
Well, it turned out to be very good, and Derry is not a bad place for us to finish up. 1977 was a year of beginnings, dreaming up new ways of doing things and setting the tone for others to follow. And many have, writing some truly great songs, but few come close to the 2 minutes and 28 seconds of pure punk pop perfection that John O'Neill wrote in his brother's bedroom in the summer of 77.
Why must I be a teenager in love?
I really don't think we thought it was that great, to be honest. I'd really get into Dion and the Belmonts a lot. I got best off Dion and the Belmonts, and Teenager in Love, and those kind of songs. The title was the first thing I remember getting. There was a song off the MC5 LP back in USA called Teenage Lust. I don't think we used to play it, but we loved, that was one of our the great records that, you know, that we had at the time. And then we used to play Route 66 by the Rolling Stones. So that was where I got Teenage, from the combination of those two things. And it just seemed like a good title. Those are days before Google, you know, when you come up with things. And I first thing I do is in Google to see if anybody got this title or am I stealing something, you know. So I knew the title was good. Teenage Kicks was one of those songs that I just wrote the whole song at one go. You know, it was in the space of 10, 15 minutes. You know, and I'm sure he talked to a lot of our musicians, songwriters. They'll say, sometimes songs like that, it does happen. You know, it's not that unusual. And it's fantastic. And no, most of the time, they're usually your best songs that are written like that. You just don't have to think too much. It never fails to amaze me that. Whenever we used to play Gloria, I always remember thinking we started doing it because it was so easy to play and such a great song. And that's an obviously Gloria is far better than Teenage Kicks. But, you know, I always used to think it'd be great to write a song that, you know, a band just starting can play, just to give them, you know, make them feel, oh, that's great, I can play this, maybe I can do something myself. That was always something, was always at the back of my mind anyway. And obviously it's great that Teenage Kicks become a song again now.
Hope you enjoyed our little trip back in time. Thanks for listening. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. I'm Carl Funge and this is Teenage Kicks.
What a treat. Street. Another girl in the neighborhood.
She looks so good.